going further with the question. So there are two scenarios. One of them, I have two signals coming from two different generators. The signals are exactly the same voltage and the same frequency. I need to create a... So it's like two primary Tesla coils that are feeding inductive coupling, feeding the secondary Tesla coil at high voltage. Now, I need to have a 90 degrees phase difference between those two. So that 8405A, let me drop it, has a two probes, so I would be able to find it. Do I understand it properly, or you can correct me, intuition?
Okay, to get 90 degrees of phase shift between the two signal generators, you could put a quarter wavelength of extra cable to one antenna versus the other. But at 100 kilohertz, that's a very long piece of cable. A much more intelligent way of doing it would be use an operational amplifier. There are ways you can set up a high-frequency operational amplifier where you've got two separate operational amplifier outputs. One is zero phase and one is 90 degrees in phase, delay or advance. So with an operational amplifier on a small circuit, on a printed circuit board, you can create two signals that are almost exactly 90 degrees apart electronically. To do it with physical length of cable, you need a huge roll of cable to do it. Over to you, Wes, N2XJN, K2IW.
No, I know how to do it. I don't know how to measure it. I mean, I need to make sure that I have 90 degrees. N2XJN.
A dual trace oscilloscope would give you a very good measurement. Not high in accuracy, but high in visibility. You look at the two signals on a dual trace oscilloscope, and if there's 90 degrees of phase shift between the two signals, one signal will be at peak while the other one goes through zero volts. So recognizing 90 degrees of phase shift on an oscilloscope with a dual trace is very easy. The next step would be to make a residue pattern. Feed one signal into the vertical plates, feed the other signal into the horizontal plates. If the amplitudes are the same and there's exactly 90 degrees of phase shift between the two, you will draw a perfect circle on the screen. As you go to different phase shifts, the circle will become an ellipse. One ellipse will be at a 45 degree angle to the right for advancing phase, and the other one will be a 45 degree slant to the left ellipse. But so there's various ways an oscilloscope could visualize the phase shift between the two for you. I will admit that using an oscilloscope, you probably cannot resolve better than 10 degrees. To resolve better than 10 degrees, you do need a vector voltmeter. That vector voltmeter is capable of a tenth of a degree of phase shift of resolution. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Thank you for telling me that. Now, I know about the ability to see it on the oscilloscope. The problem is that you have two Tesla coils wind bifillary, like bifillar, and one is connected to one generator, second is connected to the second generator. Both of them are identical. The frequency and voltage is exactly the same, but then you have in the middle that high voltage coil. So I was thinking that if I use a oscilloscope, I will simply not be able to forbid the influence of that extra, of the high voltage coil, and not would be able to see the phase difference. But thank you very much for your help.
Yeah, the major radiation coming out of a Tesla coil is that tall vertical winding with usually some kind of a capacitive hat on the top of it. And if you built two Tesla coils as identical as you possibly could, I guarantee one would have a little bit more capacitance than the other one. There'd be a little bit of phase shift in that tall vertical winding. So you'd want to make an electrical measurement to confirm phase. Just making the signals going in 90 degrees out of phase might not be good enough. The tuning of that vertical coil, and by the way, by you adding a small piece of copper tape to the top of one of the Tesla coils, will create an extra gimmick capacitor that will delay the phase of that one. When you find out which one is advanced in phase, you can easily tune them to be identical by putting small pieces of copper tape on one of them to make the tuning identical. Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Yeah, you actually explained that what is the mechanism of changing the phase angle. That is a raising up the top capacitor up and down. That I know. I was interested with means of measurement. You helped me a lot. Thank you very much. And to exchange.
Okay, Wes. Let's see if Rich has come back. N2EO. K2LAW, good, Rich.
DC2DAW with a question.
Mr. DAW, start off with your name, sir.
The name is Curtis.
Okay, you're blank, number 2, DAW. Is it the N2DAW? Go ahead, Curtis. Tell me that and then proceed with your question.
KC2DAW, Kilo Charlie 2, Delta Alpha Whiskey. And my question is, I just got this new radio and I need help programming it.
Okay. I think you're saying that the owner's manual is probably written in Chinglish. And the programming, particularly the Baofengs and the Waxongs, they program a little bit different, quite a bit different than your Yaesu, Kenwood, and ICOM. So all of us are going through a great big learning curve on finding out how to program. There was a guy who made for us a cheat sheet that he was handing out, which I'm looking at one right now. I wish I had written his call letters on here. Maybe I did. There's a guy you can write to where he can give you a crib sheet that tells you how to program a Waxon or a Yaesu. What's the model number and brand name of the rig that you want to learn how to program? Back to you, Curtis.
Okay, thanks. It's SoCo Tron, and it's ST7900D.
I think you said SoCo Tron. SJ or something like that, 9400. 7900 Baker. Now, in the past, on rigs that have a slight amount of popularity, you Google that model number and maybe add the word instruction manual or programming or whatever. Quite often there are a number of YouTube videos showing you how to program particular radios. That's worth a try. The radio you're mentioning right now, I'm not familiar with it. When you come back, tell us once again the model number. Maybe somebody listening to us is familiar with that rig. Back to you, Curtis. KC2DAW, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay. It's ST7900D.
Okay. Is anybody out there familiar with the programming of a Sugar Tango dash 7900 Bravo? If so, give us your call letters right now. K2IW and TechNet. Curtis, did that radio come with a owner's manual? And quite often the problem is the interpretation of the owner's manual. They've got maybe the right words, but they didn't use good English, so it's hard to interpret. If you go to a guy who is very familiar with 2-meter radios, I'm assuming this is ham radios. Go to somebody that's good and familiar with ham radios. Many of those guys have become pretty skilled at translating the owner's manual Chinglish into real English, and they can figure out how to do the programming. Had you gone to Ham Radio University today, or you go to one of the Limock flea markets, and you walk up to somebody like Andy, WA2CDL, there's probably a good chance he can look at that owner's manual, even if he's not familiar with that particular radio, and tell you how to do programming. I presume you've tried programming, and so far you haven't been able to get it on the right frequency with the right PL so that you can turn on the right repeater. Is that approximately what's happening, Curtis? KC2DAW, K2LIW.
Yep, that's the problem. Yep, KC2DAW, K2RW. Yep, that's the problem.
Yeah, you're going to have to find somebody that knows how to do that translating. It's about the best I can recommend for you. See if I get. I got my wires tangled up here. Oh, there we are. I wasn't hearing any signal out of my earphones. That makes me unhappy. And I think you said the brand name is Solatron. I spell that brand name. And I presume that's a Southeast Asia radio. Go ahead, Curtis.
Okay. It's S-O-C-O-T-R-A-N.
Yeah, I would pronounce that Solatran. And so, out of curiosity, where did you buy it? And is it a nice price? Over to you, Curtis.
Yeah, I got it off Amazon, and it was, I believe it was $79.99 or something, I think. But I also got the antenna with it, and the programming disc, which is not working either for the radio. I guess it's the computer or something. It's not, you know, loading it up properly. But it was altogether, it was $119.99.
Is this a dual band, or is this a 2-meter radio? And is it a 5-watt heady talkie, so to speak?
Oh no, it's supposed to be a mobile, but I'm using it as a base station. It's a quad band.
Quad band for that price, boy, you're getting a lot of radio for your money. And right now, I think you're saying. You're the only human being you know of on planet Earth that owns one of those radios. Is it something that came out very recently, Curtis? Go ahead.
I think so.
Okay, you've got our permission to come back in future weeks as more people eventually discover this great buy of this radio and people start acquiring it. We'll eventually find somebody who has actually used it. But in the meantime, if you go to a flea market or a ham radio university, you will find people. There's always a couple of guys who are extremely skilled at all the crazy manipulations of programming a radio from its front panel. There are a number of radios where there's a program you plug into a desktop computer and connect it with a cable, and it supposedly helps you to do the programming. But there's always a slight difference in the cable, a slight difference in the integrated circuit chip that's on the cable. The program may or may not be compatible with your particular operating system of your computer. There's always that interface problem that quite a few guys have run into. So it's going to take you a while. But I recommend you don't give up. You'll eventually find out how to do it. You have seen power output from that radio so far. Is that true, Curtis?
I think so.
How can you tell you're getting power output? Just by the way the front panel lights up, and maybe it's got a slide rule dial.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it doesn't sound like we've got anybody on channel tonight who's familiar with that radio. And because it's Southeast Asia, there's a good chance that the way you program a Roxxon or a can't even think of the brand names, but those two very popular brand names. If you, let's see now, do I have one here with me? No, I don't. I mentioned them earlier. If you look at the YouTube videos that tell you how to program a Luxon or a Balfong, in my opinion, there's a 90% chance that because they're both Southeast Asia, they might have very similar programming techniques, which is different than Yaesu, ICOM, and Kenwood. But there's a good chance that they program in a similar manner. So first, of course, do all kinds of Google search with Soliton, Soliton, and that model number. There's a good chance you'll find something, but if not, Google Luxon and Balfong and follow that procedure, and I think there's a 90% chance that it'll work. Back to you, Curtis, K2LIW, and come back next week and let us know what you found out.
BC2GS.
Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I've been looking for it on Amazon, and I can't really find it. Unless he got it directly shipped from China, if there's some kind of United States distributor that distributed it, he probably can contact them and ask them for help. Also, a lot of times these remote cables use a pirated chipset, and relatively new operating systems can detect that and stop people from getting anywhere with them. If he has any older computers that have Windows 7 or Windows ME or something that's working, he might want to try the drivers on that. They might work on older operating systems.
3LTC with a comment.
Something ALTC or something like that. Give us the call letter slowly, your name, and then your comment. Go right ahead, sir.
Kilo 3 Lima Tango Charlie, this is Nate, and just a comment for Curtis that I did find it on Amazon. I have not been able to find the manufacturer of this radio, but yeah, it's definitely it's an Asian import mobile quad band. Looks interesting. I remember seeing it in the past too, pretty cheap, but yeah, I can't find a website to, you know, go check out a manual.
And Nate, do you see any evidence that there is an American distributor, or do you think it's being shipped directly from China? Over to you, Nate.
Well, unfortunately, my radio doesn't reach my computer. My shack isn't set up perfectly here, so I can't really tell, but it doesn't look like it's got... I'll get back to you in a minute or so.
Okay, so while we're waiting for that, we're going to go over to Roy with the science talk section, but I think you should start off first. I'm looking forward to your puzzle, but I'm even looking forward first to a little bit of a description of what was Ham Radio University like for you with Andy. Yesterday, you and Andy were put on apparently quite a show of using test equipment to display what an AM and FM and sideband modulated signal looks like on an oscilloscope. AC2GS, K2RAW, go ahead, Roy.
Yes, thank you very much, Dick. I had the pleasure of working with Andy, WA2CDL. He wanted to put on a kind of a work group as far as test equipment goes. So he brought a lot of test equipment. He brought old CRT-based oscilloscope. He brought his station monitor. He brought an antenna analyzer. He brought a piece of test equipment that you could test different things on an oscilloscope by probing different probes within it. The problem is we sort of figured out that 40 minutes goes very, very, very fast. And people asked all kinds of interesting questions that caused us to go this way and that. And although Andy started with the oscilloscope, he quickly jumped over to the station monitor because someone wanted to know about the description of microphones how much output level, what it does, what do the curves look like, and we were talking about FM modulation and amplitude modulation and audio envelopes on waveforms, and it was loads of fun. Andy was going to do a little bit on Lissajou figures as well, because we all kind of remember The Outer Limits opened with those beautiful oscilloscope pictures. But we only had 40 minutes, so we could have filled a day and a half.
Sounds like you were getting lots of questions. I know he had a arbitrary waveform generator, an oscilloscope, a service monitor. That allows you to generate and view quite a few signals. Someday it would be nice to be able to display on an oscilloscope screen an amplitude-modulated RF signal, where you can see, two of the envelopes, so to speak, and a sideband signal with a triangular display. But that's what you guys are going to do next year. I am guessing you had a good amount of participation from the audience asking questions and saying, what does that mean, and how do I do this? Is that true, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, it turned into a veritable little mini technical net. Every time we answered one question, someone else had another question either related to that or parallel to that. So it was lots of fun, and it was like I was sitting here at the TechNet. And at the very, very end, as people were getting up, I brought along a little bag of my 3D models that I had. I opened up the box last week, and I showed people, and I wasn't quite sure exactly whether people would care or not. And a lot of people really were interested, especially in the high tolerance that you can print things. You can print things that swivel and rotate all in one printing job. You don't have to do it individually because the tolerances are so great. There's a bunch of people interested in that as well. So it was a fun time had by all.
The models that you brought of your 3DB, your three-dimensional printer, I presume these are a plastic-like, almost clear material, or a milky-shaped material that was being printed. And I'm guessing in some cases you could make a square cage with a smaller square cage inside of it that's freely, the inside one is freely floating compared to the outside one. Is that possible, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes, indeed, Dick. I brought it looks like a dome. You know, it's a half of a hemisphere with about six different layers inside each other, and they all pivot at 90 degrees to each other, and you can just roll them around almost like a gyroscope. 3D plastic is filaments. Each of them, there's PLA, there's ABS. They have different points, slightly different qualities. Most of them are either very, none of them are clear. Simply the unfortunate modeling technology tends to create refraction and cloudiness. And a lot of the filaments have dyes in them. So I had red and black and white and all max for plastic. I had little sculptures. I had objects with constant width that you could use as a ball bearing. I had all kinds of fun little things to show people. It was fun.
Sure does sound like you had a good time. I am guessing you and Andy also probably sat in on a couple of other lectures. I hear tell the one by WY2U on the magnetic loop antenna that Mike Cosma had another very good presentation. So did you get a chance to see some other lectures? And I also heard that the individual classrooms, so to speak, are a little bit smaller than they were at the previous location. So that was the one thing that was not quite ideal. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Yes, Dick. Some of them were rather tiny, and unfortunately, they really liked to use the furnace there. It was a bit too hot in one of the rooms. Someone fainted. I don't know exactly. I understand he went to the hospital for some observation. Hopefully he's... it was a little on the hot side. I took in that exact seminar on the magnetic loop And I don't know. It's curious. I understand he's an electrical engineer. People seem to have different opinions about magnetic loops. Some people think that the currents are pretty much distributed equally across them, and other people are very strongly inclined to believe they're like dipoles. The current has its peak towards the feed point, and the voltage has its peak towards the other edges where the capacitors are. And he's one of the guys who believes in the constant current. I didn't dispute it with him, but I find it curious.
What's peculiar about this situation, Roy, is that all of magnetic loops are all of the above. Every magnetic loop is a mixture of dipole-like current distribution and equal current distribution. The biggest variable is what is the wavelength of circumference at your particular operating frequency of your particular loop. If you built a loop on, say, 2 meters, where a dipole would be something like 38 inches tip to tip, and you folded it into a circle, you would have a very dipole-like pattern. As you made it smaller and smaller in circumference, but keep resonating it, you would be moving closer and closer to equal current around the loop. As the loop goes to near zero circumference in wavelength, the antenna becomes more and more omnidirectional. You always have a little bit of wow to the azimuthal antenna pattern. As if the loop is now, let me drop. Assuming the loop is parallel to the ground, therefore it's horizontally polarized, the plane of the loop is parallel to the ground, as you make the loop smaller and smaller but keep resonating it, the current becomes more and more uniform around the loop, and the pattern becomes more and more omnidirectional. As you make the loop closer and closer to a half wavelength in circumference, it becomes more and more dipole-like in its antenna pattern. So the current distribution is a function of how the resonance is taking place. If the amount of inductance of the loop is so small that there's very little time delay within the loop itself, that all the time delay is the resonance phenomena between the great big capacitor and the inductor that's connected to it, it becomes more and more uniform in current distribution and becomes more and more omnidirectional. Does that make a little bit more sense, though, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, it does. Your answer pretty much kind of sounds like it's somewhere in between, which I'm much happier with than any extreme. Another thing that I found curious, he defined the magnetic loops as less than a quarter of a wavelength in circumference. I've seen other literature that describes it as one-tenth or less of a wavelength. So that's another curious thing I have.
Yeah, now we're into the semantics. You could literally take a half wavelength dipole, curve it into a circle, make sure that the two tips that are coming close together are far enough apart that there's very little strayed capacitance. It's got a great big open gap, so to speak. It'll still stay resonant at the frequency, and it'll still pretty much have a dipole-like pattern. As you start moving those tips closer and closer together, it'll come down in frequency, but you make the circumference smaller to bring it back up in frequency. And so whether or not you're going to make it a quarter wavelength circumference, eighth of a wavelength, tenth of a wavelength, those are your choices as a designer. As you make the number of wavelengths smaller and smaller, the Q of the antenna goes up. The voltage across the capacitor gets higher and higher. The bandwidth gets more and more narrow. The antenna becomes very narrowband as you make it smaller, but the current distribution becomes more uniform and the pattern becomes more omnidirectional. So if you're going to call it a magnetic loop if it's less than a quarter wave, and you're going to call it a dipole if it's more than a quarter wave, that's semantics. Tomato, tomato, if you know what I mean. There's no clearly defined definition along those lines, in my opinion, that all antenna engineers would agree to. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Okay, Okay, very good, Dick. Yes, I know semantics is the hobgoblin of small minds. So, I understand that it's just the name people give to it. But it was a very enjoyable forum. There were a lot of nice forums. I took in WB2E's History of Radio, all the way from spark gap to software-defined radio, and the question I had is how the heck he was going to do it in 40 minutes. The answer is he actually kept going for about an hour and 20 minutes. Went into the ARRL guy looking in the auditorium, but it was a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, you're having a dropout every 20 seconds or so, a dropout for a fraction of a second. Right at the time you gave me the call letters of the guy giving the history of radio, we missed those call letters. Please repeat that, Roy, go ahead.
I still have the dropout. WB2EAV, Ed.
Yeah, good old Ed Gellender. And another guy who is very into that is, all of a sudden I can't think of his call letters. It'll come to me in a minute. There's another guy who's collecting pictures of all of the early radio days. And quite a bit of early radio did take place on Long Island. And so Ed is also quite familiar with that. Ed is big into D3 aircraft, early days of radio, and also I think he's a bit of an expert on certain kinds of a firearm. Sounds like he had a good time at Ham Radio University. I'm looking forward, if you're going to have your puzzle tonight about where is the energy flowing in an elevator with more and less people on the elevator, more and less load, if that's your puzzle tonight, I'm looking forward to it. And for people who go to the Kings County Radio Club website, if you look at the technical nets, the past technical nets of Roy, AC2GS, for one every month, you'll see some of these puzzles. Some of them are very good. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. First, I want to say the same thing I say every time, that if anyone has any topics or questions or reputations, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. A lot of what I say will have links available. There's a link page. I made a new one for 2019, but you could go back to the 2018 if you want. And the way to get there is just to type in roy.ac2gs.com, and it will take you to the link. And we do take requests, so we'll do the elevator puzzle first, and we'll see how that goes.
And Roy likes people to participate, so make sure you don't be afraid of giving an answer that you're afraid that won't be right. Go ahead and give answers if he, in his puzzle, asks for answers. You got it, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Okay, we all use elevators. You know, thanks to the Otis Elevator patented safety designs long, long ago, there's two major types of elevators. There's something called the traction elevator, which we're much more used to seeing. Those have cables. There's another one that uses hydraulics. It's a hydraulic elevator. This question is going to be about the traction type. So let's try not to make this too overly complicated, because you can think this thing and get stuck in semantics and all kinds of things. There's lots of new technology, flywheels, energy storage devices, so as not to waste energy. But let's assume that this is a relatively simple traction elevator. Now, the question is, you got this elevator. It goes up, it goes down. You want to save power requirements. I mean, there's even a version, there's a setting on some elevators called the Shabbos elevator that stops at each floor, opens, closes, and goes up and down so that people don't have to push the button. Anyway, the question tonight for me, to you, does it take less power to raise and lower, to operate an elevator when it's empty, when it's full, when it's half full, when it's quarter full, when it's third full, whatever. What are people's idea of what's the most efficient? If you had to load it with X number of pounds, what would you do to make it the most efficient G-using device.
KD2FYU. George.
Yes, George.
Hi, Roy, and good evening, everybody. I'm thinking of simply of the oldest type of elevator. Most energy would be used for it to go down, for the cage to go down empty.
Okay, for the purpose of this exercise, we're adding up the up and the down, because, you know, an elevator can only go down once before it has to go up again. So this is an elevator that just keeps going to the top floor, the bottom floor, the top floor, the bottom floor, and right now it's empty. And you're the guy who's paying the electrical bill, and you want to pay as little as humanly possible. Would you leave the elevator empty to do this? Would you put something in the elevator? How much would you put if you put something in the elevator?
Roy, I didn't get that far. Let me keep thinking about this, because you just brought in three or four questions there. KD2FIU.
WS2N.
Cool.
Okay, and happy new year, by the way, Roy and Dick and everybody else. I would go with the maximum weight, whatever is allowed, you know, in that type of an elevator. Not the hydraulic one, but the one with the pulley on top, and because you've got the counterweight, and the counterweights, I believe, they are actually over the weight of an empty elevator. So just in case you load up the elevator, that's going to counterbalance it, you know, exactly. So I'm going to go with loading up the whole elevator, because then there's, you know, it's just a motor strain for that elevator. Just setting up the motors. It won't be dragging up this big counterweight on that with an empty elevator. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, Paul, and a happy and a healthy new year to you and yours. So that's a good thought, that the counterweight has to be kept in mind. So you would, if it was, say, a one-ton capacity elevator, you would put a bunch of anvils and stuff in the elevator to load it up to the maximum capacity with going up and down by itself. That's what you're saying?
QSO.
Very good. Anyone else with any ideas or suggestions for this problem? It's going up and down no matter what you do. It's set on autopilot, and you are going to get the bill at the end of the month, and the less the bill, the better. What would you do to this elevator of yours?
DH with a question.
Let me say real quick, I'm going into the tunnel. I would say with it empty, with it, the counterweight's balanced perfectly, you're going to use the least amount of energy moving it up and down.
Interesting.
Second, so Eric says an empty elevator, Paul says a full elevator. What do you say, Wesley?
Doesn't make any difference. Up, down, you have a counterbalance. And when you're balancing up, you're balancing down. There's no difference. Enter exchange.
Okay, so it's another person. I didn't catch his call sign.
Yes, WA2VDH. Question about the counterweights.
Hey.
Yeah, are the counterweights adjusted to exactly balance the empty weight of the elevator cab, or are they set somewhere in between? Say half loaded or full loaded or what? What is the actual setting of the weight of the counterweights? Go ahead.
That's basically the solution to the puzzle.
Yeah, I've got a guess as to what I think the average elevator company does on this one, Roy. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. When you get a chance, I'll give you my guess.
One more comment.
Just wait.
Okay. In traction elevator, you have a magnetic synchronous motor in place in machine room. And then you using a counterbalance system. That counterbalance is to balance the weight. So when you're going up, you use the same amount of energy when you're going down. And to exchange.
I disagree with that a little bit.
Okay, before Dick gives away the answer, does anyone else have any ideas? We kind of covered everything. We covered empty. We covered full. We covered it doesn't make any difference. So if anyone else has any thoughts.
Yes,
please.
I'm actually going to say that it should be probably roughly halfway, because I would imagine the elevator manufacturer would want to sort of split the difference in terms of what the counterweight would be to maximize efficiency going both ways. So I'm going to say roughly 50% of the...
Very good. And for the piece de resistance, Dick, what is your thoughts on the matter?
The elevator motor itself, I believe in the old days, was not a synchronous AC motor. It was a DC motor with a commutator and brushes. And how often you have to replace those brushes is a function of how much current flows through them. Also a function of the design of the brushes and so on. So you'd like to not replace the brushes very often. Therefore, you want the current load on the motor to be as light as possible most of the time. I think they adjust the counterweight to be roughly intermediate between the lightest load and the heaviest load. So if your elevator can possibly hold, let me pick a number, 10 people, then you might set the counterweight for the average situation of 5 people. And if you did set the counterweight that way, and you had 5 people in the elevator, the weight of the elevator and the weight of the counterweight would be identical, almost like a seesaw with equal weight people on both sides of the seesaw. Therefore, with the motor applying no torque, the elevator would sit in one spot. And now, all the motor has to do in that example is to go up, as the elevator has to apply a little bit of force to accelerate the elevator plus counterweight, and then while it's traveling, it doesn't do any work. Then it has to decelerate the elevator when it gets to the top, so to speak, and the reverse when you come back down. So, minimum use of motor. Minimum wear on the brushes is when the load and the counterweight are equal to each other. When there is imbalance, let me drop. When either there's nobody in the elevator and therefore the counterweight is too heavy, or the elevator is really completely full and it's more than the counterweight, now the motor has to continuously supply a torque. If, for instance, the elevator is really full and it's more heavy than the counterweight, the motor Nesta has to supply quite a bit of positive torque to raise the elevator. It has to use an awful lot of negative torque when the elevator is going back down to make sure it doesn't go too fast. In the case of the DC motor going back down, the motor is now pumping current back into its power supply, and because of the way Con Ed is wired, I don't think you recover that power, so to speak, on the way down. But there, I'm not sure. But you'd like to have the motor to do the minimum amount of work. Therefore, you try to adjust the counterweight to be as close as possible to the weight of the elevator most of the time. Those are my guesses, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
One more.
Just wait. Hey, here it is.
DAW for comment.
First Wesley, then Eric, then DA.
Most of them use magnetic synchronous motor in machine room. So that's the major inconvenience. But other than that, when you have a constant balance system and forget about the increasing the speed, the energy used when you're going up versus energy use when you're going down should be the same. I didn't cover the part when it's empty or when it's full of people. Interaction.
If it's a synchronous motor, how do you make it run slower when you desire to?
No, we weren't asked for that. We were asked for the energy use. So we exclude that option.
Enter exchange.
EQ-HUC with a comment.
Eric is next, then VDH, then HUC.
Okay, I'm just wondering if you can hear me. Are we talking about an elevator which has mechanical advantages by way of pulling, which kind of changes it, the torque and the load on the motor and the speed at which the motor has to turn. So, to me, the empty car and the counterweights being perfectly balanced, for the majority of the time the thing's empty, that is where you save the most in energy. Once you put some load in it, then you're going to use some more energy. And as far as slowing it down, and I'm assuming we're not talking about an electromagnetic brake, that you're going to want to just short the field winding to use that.
So understood. VDH, I think you're next.
Yeah, what I would probably suggest, maybe it's getting too complicated, but set the counterweights at some type of statistical mean of between the full load and no load. I guess find out what it's, what the RMS value is of the load, and set the counterweights for that. So on the average, it would minimize the work done. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. And HUC had a comment?
Dick brought up the fact, you know, whether or not it was an AC or a DC motor. First off, we can confirm that the DC motor, unless you have a lot of technology up there, which most don't, you're not pushing the DC back into Con Ed. You're either fed by rectifiers or whatnot that are unidirectional. So that's not going to work. You're not pushing the power back to Edison. The other thing is that I would be looking at how much torque the motor has to apply when it's starting, because as everybody knows, the inrush is, you know, 8 times what the normal running current of the motor is. So if the counterweight is heavier than the cost than the average car, then I would say the motor, when it has to drive the car down, most times when it's empty, it's the startup going down is going to be more than when it's going up. So in that case, limit it and make it work like Roy was saying, the Chabot elevator. You got to go up to go down, if you understand what I'm...
82NSJ.
Yeah.
82NSJ, we'll answer.
Sam, recognize. Please give us your answer.
Okay. It sounds crazy what I'm going with common sense. The elevator is going up and down on its own, and you're worried about paying a lot of electric bill, I would hire an operator, and this way it only goes up when somebody's in the car.
Then you got to pay this guy all kinds of things and his medical insurance, so it gets rather expensive after a while, doesn't it?
Yes, but if nobody's getting on and off that elevator, it's still going up and down. You know, like if you got a 9-to-5 shift and people come in early, they all go, and then around 10 or 11 o'clock, that elevator's still moving, whether somebody's in there or not. So I don't know, maybe I pay a minimum wage.
One more comment.
82FIU. First Wesley, then George.
It most likely works like that. When the power flows into the motor, it creates lifting torque on the shaft of the electroship, and lifting is lifting the carriage. When the carriage travels down, the motor acts as a generator, transforming mechanical power into the electrical power and pumping current back into the facility electrical grid to use elsewhere. That's how the most of them works. When the cups go up with the light load and down with heavy load, the system generates more power than it uses. So over the time, the small amounts of power generated during each elevator decelerations, let me jump up, they add up and you have a noticeable savings. That's for the overall. They use less energy than non-regenerative drives with the old cups, old shafts
reducing the access feed to the building. And that's mostly how the new lifts works like. Enter here.
Hey, Wesley, George, you wanted to say something?
I'd like to add another fact that it may be considered here in efficiency. We're understanding a little bit about the motors, the type of motors, of course, the counterweight system, but there's also the percentage of usage that may be a factor. A lot of elevators spend most of their time taxiing empty to a floor. So go from the lobby to the sixth floor empty to get the person on the sixth floor or a full group of people on the sixth floor. And the other way, I've been in buildings where elevators always arrive, or let's say most of the time, arrive empty. This may also be a factor on how we want to say what's efficient. We understand the motors, we understand the weights to some degree, but how much time is it spent taxiing empty?
So Wesley, and there's someone in the background. I couldn't make out any kind of an ID, though. Wesley, I can hear you, so we'll go with Wesley, and then we'll give the other person another chance to break through to the repeater.
The problem that we have is that you didn't specify whether we're talking about the old-fashioned traditional lift or the new one. With the old-fashioned, if it's properly counterweight, there is no difference between lift up and lift down. With the new one, because we have the motor acting as a generator that is transforming that mechanical power into the electrical energy, we cannot really say about up down because it's a single event. We should take it in the time frame, and it's going to come exactly the same. Only the cost would be smaller, the overall cost. So if you put delta T of 2 days or 2 hours, then we're coming to the same. That's what I believe is the right answer.
WS1.
Okay, so we're done. Cool.
Yeah, Roy, I was thinking about the answer I gave. I'm going to stick with that, where you would have more counterweight than that's necessary. And then, so it would be better if you loaded up the elevator, and then that would, equal the weight of the counterweight. Well, I always thought they had to have it that way because of safety. You don't want it, half and half. You don't want a situation where you're going to load up the elevator with people and have more people in that elevator, more weight on the elevator than the counterweights in case something fails. Although systems that they have, they won't fail, but suppose they did fail, they'd rather have the elevator go in the up position than go down and accelerate, as time goes on. Before you know it, you're gonna hit out at the bottom of the street. You don't want to be going 30 miles an hour when you hit the bottom. They'd rather have you go up than down. Back to you, Roy.
Hey, Paul, that's a legitimate way of looking at it. The thing to think about is the whole reason why elevators really took off with the Otis elevator was the safety design, that you can snap the cable. I wouldn't recommend it, but you can snap the cable, and there are safety features in the elevator that will pretty much guarantee it's stopping. It's not going to slam down. It's you really have to have a terrible disaster to have a well-designed elevator actually drop down all that way. So I understand and appreciate the trauma, the drama of it all, and it's been in movies all over the place. I've seen it myself in movies. That's not really the big problem. The really big problem, as was mentioned before, was the motor and the torque and the maximum amount of power that you're going to use during the cycle. So keeping that in mind, there was at least one or two other people who wanted to say something.
Sure,
sorry.
No, I'm just wondering where the relevance of this is in terms of, like, most of the elevated motors that I've seen actually go through some kind of a step start and step stop procedure in terms of doing its work. But it seems as though, to me, that many of these type things are... there we go. I actually have mechanical advantage from pulleys between the motor source and the actual top of the elevator, so I think that might play a role in some of this in terms of where you want to use the least amount of energy. I mean, you have the period of time that the elevator is empty, the period of time where the elevator is full, and you want to take advantage of whichever one is the major consumption.
Hey, Eric, and as far as what is the point of all this, well, I hate to get philosophical, but hopefully people will be a little informed and a little entertained. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
The question is tricky because there are many variables that are not specified. The older elevator used synchronous motor. The newer one used permanent magnet motor that is bi-directional energy flow. And that one is able to save a lot of energy when it's going down. So the one thing is balancing, so it's up, down the same. And the second thing is in terms of energy use and traction.
Hey, Wes, but way back at the beginning of this little puzzle, I mentioned let's not get it clouded with energy-saving systems to store up flywheel energy and what have you. So primarily, this is a simplified puzzle where it's a rather old-style motor that doesn't have state-of-the-art energy storage devices so that it can save up the energy and reuse it again. We're trying to make this relatively simple. It breaks down to an interesting concept, which hopefully people will find interesting. But that's the way the puzzle is posed.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yes, half and half, and to exchange. That means the same use of energy up and down with the same load on it.
You know, step start is just a bunch of resistors that make heat.
According to the Wikipedia site on elevators, some of those motors are AC-DC motors. They have both AC characteristics and DC characteristics. Some of them are AC motors with variable frequency drive, plus a braking mechanism on the motor that will hold the elevator at a particular floor. But by variable frequency drive, you can slowly accelerate the elevator the way you want it to, with the curve you want, and you can make it run at the speed you want by varying the frequency into the AC motor. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Very good, Dick. I agree with you. It's additional information, but, and we've had so many different answers that obviously there are people said the exact correct answer. I just wanted to give people another opportunity if they have anything further to say. We wrap this up in a bow.
By the way, there's a kind of elevator where the counterweight is another elevator. So there are two elevators wired in such a way that when one goes up, the other goes down. And except for the complication of always having to force one up and the other down, you can have an active counterweight made up of people. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed, Dick. That's a option you have with a traction elevator. I don't think it's commonly used because of the basic complication of you can't have two elevators going up. If one has to go up, the other one has to go down something. But yes, you can do it. You can arrange it that way. Anyone else with any comments, questions, answers, statements, such?
Yeah, I'll throw one at you. I've seen an elevator. I just wanted from the old queue from before 34, where the actual and all the other videos had a spring extension. It's adjusted pull according to the the weight of what's going on in the car itself.
Unfortunately, I think you were doubling with Sam.
Why? Why should I do that? You think I could do that?